You're listening to a program produced in 2016 by Aloud, a series of dynamic conversations, readings, and performances that take place at the historic Central Library in downtown Los Angeles. Aloud is presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To learn more, please visit lfla.org/aloud.
Tonight, Rebecca Solnit takes us on a journey into cities, with New York the focus of her most recent work, Nonstop Metropolis. The Atlas, a collection of essays and 26 gorgeous maps, is not unlike cities themselves. Rich and complex, unexpected and curious. Solnit and her collaborator for this three Atlas series, Joshua Jelly Shapiro, have truly reimagined how cities can be seen, how we inhabit them, while also sharing histories, often silent, unpopular, or forbidden. Fellow authors collaborated as essayists, and the maps, artworks in and of themselves, are made by artists and cartographers, such as Mother Tongues and Queens, the world's language capital, to Mysterious Land of Shaolin, the Wu-Tang Clan's Staten Island. In Solnit's words, a good map is an invitation to the imagination, and this work is certainly that. And although I think her three-city atlas project is now complete, I'd love to know how she might imagine an atlas for Los Angeles and all of the stories that you would contribute to it. The other two atlases part of this project are Infinite City, San Francisco, and Unfathomable City, New Orleans. Solnit received the Corliss Benefideo Award for Imaginative Cartography from the North American Cartographic Information Society for her work on the previous two atlases. Rebecca Solnit is a prolific writer and a model activist, engaged in critical social debate, pushing people to think smarter, deeper, longer. I recommend her recent piece in The Guardian, written the day before the election, as well as a previous book of hers from 2004 titled Hope in the Dark, Untold History's Wild Possibilities. It might be the perfect read or reread for this moment we are now living. Solnit also recently reported from the front lines of Standing Rock in North Dakota, and I very much hope she'll share more about that with us tonight. I don't think there is a better voice with whom to chat all things city than our own Christopher Hawthorne. As architecture critic for the LA Times, you've read his work about projects in cities near and far. Hawthorne's approach to thinking about cities always expands the conversation, probing deeper and beyond the built environment and exploring how our cities influence the way we think, make art, tell stories, and create better tomorrows. He's also the mind behind The Third Los Angeles, a project focused on telling the story of this city and, most importantly, imagining its next chapters. Please join me in welcoming to the Aloud stage at the LA Public Library, Rebecca Solnit and Christopher Hawthorne.
Thank you, Maureen. Good evening, everybody. Even just on my way in here, I saw so many familiar faces, people I hoped I would see in this audience. I knew coming in that Rebecca had such a following here, and I've been looking forward to this event since we put it on the calendar. But we were just talking backstage about how we both feel a little bit dazed by the events of the last couple days, and I think that's probably true of most people here, and we want to acknowledge it right from the start and say that maybe we can find, you know, a little bit of solidarity, a little bit of comfort in coming together to talk about some of these issues. And in fact, we both, I think, have had people reaching out to us, and there's something that Rebecca's written quite a bit about is the ways in which we find a kind of solidarity and community and after disasters of various kinds, political and otherwise.
I think probably a lot of people here are shocked and devastated and horrified and heartbroken about what might be happening to our country and the world. The cancellation of the Paris Climate Treaty, which is going to happen right away, they threaten, is like the piece of dread I've been trying to fight against for months in this election. So, you know, but it has been interesting. There's an old myth that human response is fight or flight, but actually women in particular have a third response, which is to kind of cluster for mutual aid. And it was sort of beautiful and moving to see everybody really reach out to connect, whether they needed solace or were offering refuge and solace. I think getting through these next few years is going to require a lot of generosity and solidarity. And those of us who are fairly safe in who we are and what we are, reaching out to protect the most vulnerable, the people who are Muslim, who are immigrants, who are non-white, who are queer, who are already being threatened and harassed and insulted around the country. I've heard a lot of horrible stories by this tremendous sense of empowerment of hate and intolerance and divisiveness that this election has brought.
So on that cheery note, let me thank Louise Diamond Marine, the Library Aloud series, for having us. Let me give you a quick sense of the structure of the evening. Rebecca has prepared a few slides, mostly about New York, that she will do now at the top of the program, and then we will reconvene to talk not just about this book, but about the trilogy of atlases, of which this is the third, and then about cities beyond those three, San Francisco, New Orleans, and now New York, and some thoughts about Los Angeles, if we can get there. And then we'll have some questions from all of you at the end. Let's get to Boyle Heights.
Does any of you know this place, other than my wonderful cousins in the audience, in Boyle? Does anybody else know this in Boyle Heights? It's been a family shoe store since my dad grew up in it, and when Boyle Heights was Jewish. And it's still a family shoe store, but now I forget what it is. Like Gutierrez, Guerrero, something like that, shoes, and they're lovely. Go buy footwear there. But Maureen wanted me to start with L.A. I do love being here. My dad did grow up here. I have wonderful relatives here. I just went to see my father's first cousin, June, who talked about surviving McCarthyism as a kind of formative experience. And so, like, we're going to go to New York, but I thought we would start where we are. This is actually, I have never shown this slide in a talk before, I don't think. This is the first creative map I ever made. In response to Pete Wilson and Prop 187 and the English-only bullshit of the 1990s. I commissioned a map of California with all Spanish words taken off, which is impossible because California is a Spanish word. And when you take off Los Angeles and San Diego and Santa Rosa and Santa Cruz and Sacramento and San Francisco, when all the saints go marching out of the state, you get a place that looks really pretty bereft and boring and empty. You know, you don't get San Francisco, but you get Hayward. You don't get Los Angeles, but you might get like Brentwood or something. So that was my first foray into maps as a kind of political and cultural expression. And there's things that maps do that are just powerful and direct and immediate and extraordinary. I write books. I'm done with making atlases. I've made three, which, if you know how much work they are, is a lot. I began this process in 2008 with the San Francisco Atlas, which came out in 2010, New Orleans in 2013, and last month this one. This is a map from the New York Atlas that did two things. And some of our maps are contemporary, some historical, and some sort of, there needs to be a tense that's like manifesto, propositional. This addresses two things, one of which is that New York has an extraordinary history of great women, powerful women, some of the leading feminists, labor organizers, revolutionaries, hip-hop stars, divas, drag queens, and everything else in this country. Three of our three current female Supreme Court justices are New Yorkers. And yet women don't really have a place in this city. Things are not named after them. We live in what I now realize from doing this map is what I call a manscape. And, you know, two of the boroughs in New York City are named after men. Boulevards, monuments, parks, bridges, etc. There's only five statues of women in New York City, of actual historical women, not abstractions like Lady Liberty. And women are really missing from the landscape. This map has been extraordinary to have out there. And a young woman, I talked to some young women when I was in New York last month. What would it be like to live in a city that reflected, you know, your gender and race? And one of them said to me, I've slouched my whole life. I would walk up straight in a city, you know, named after people like me. And the other one said, I would feel like I had the right to occupy space that I don't feel now. And then she looked at us all and said, would I be sexually harassed on a boulevard named after a great woman? That makes a big difference. And, you know, our cities are mostly white men. But this is an atlas that I see as a repudiation of Donald Trump. He's allegedly from New York, but I wrote him a letter last week asking if he'd ever been to New York City. Because New York City, it has 500,000 undocumented immigrants, and they are, as Mayor Bloomberg said, if they left, the city would fall apart. They pay taxes, they work hard, they hold it all together. There are 500,000 or so Muslims, 237 mosques in New York. They keep talking like if there are undocumented immigrants and Muslims in our country, there will be something terrible will happen. And New York City is like, they're here and it's fine. Get over it. So it's a city of powerful women, of feminists, of queer people, of black people. 37% of New Yorkers are immigrants. It is a great capital of Latino radio and Spanish language radio, the most listened to radio stations in the city, which this map documents are Spanish language. And so like Los Angeles, it's a great Latin American capital. In fact, New York is where salsa evolved and then went back to Latin America. So here's a detail. And it's also the most linguistically diverse place in the world. Those 37% immigrants are everyone from everywhere. Unlike the West Coast, there's a lot of African people there as well. But you have endangered languages where people have been driven out of their homes. You know, and this is what the Statue of Liberty is about. And part of what I think has made this country, when it is great, which it often isn't, is as a place of refuge for dissenters and minorities and rebels and queer people, et cetera. My grandparents were refugees from the pogroms of Russia when they came to Boyle Heights. So this is a map of Queens, the most linguistically diverse place on Earth, with these endangered languages no longer spoken anywhere else in the world, as well as common languages like Urdu and Turkish and Romanian and things like that. And then last, we celebrated all the kinds of wild... The cities are... You know, these kind of daytime places of rationality and production and profit. But a kind of, they're also something else, places of desire and ecstasy, of spirituality and eroticism, which for this map, inspired by my friend Tino Rodriguez, a queer refugee from Mexico and a longtime friend of mine, inspired by his artwork, we really celebrated the joy people take in the wildlife that's now flourishing in so many cities. I know LA is great with coyotes, but even New York has them now too. So, and hawks and wild birds and skunks and raccoons and whales in the harbor and et cetera. So really trying to celebrate this city as what cities have been. And it's something Christopher and I were talking about. You can stop the slides now. In the green room is that when you look at the election map, I haven't looked at it for this painful presidential election, but most years I know the cities are blue, the suburbs are red. And so the map of the United States, not by the state level where they just pretend we're all red or all blue, but by the county level, you see an archipelago of blue, which are the population centers where people have learned to coexist with each other. And that's what these maps are about, with these pairings that began with a map called Monarchs and Queens about butterfly species and queer public spaces in San Francisco 8 years ago. It's about celebrating the sort of clashes and coexistences and complexities of cities and the ways that they become these kind of trusts of what I think is best and most powerful and creative and generous in this country.
And did you think of it as a trilogy from the beginning? How did you seize on the idea of an atlas as a way to organize this set of really ideas and arguments about cities? And did you think you'd take it beyond San Francisco when you begin?
I know, sort of step by step. And atlases began in 2007 when San Francisco Museum of Modern Art's curator freshly arrived from New York. asked me to propose a project for the museum's 75th anniversary, which was 2010. And I'd been thinking about trying to articulate some things about cities and to celebrate what maps can do in this era where maps are sort of fading from everyday use, you know. And so SF MoMA said yes to the project of doing a series of broadsides and public events. But of course, for me, all roads lead to books. So I ran across the bay to University of California Press and said I want to do an atlas. And I'd never done anything like it. I've worked a lot with artists, and I've worked on the design of books and print projects and things. But it was insane. It was really fun. It was also about kind of coming home literally after the Bush era, where I'd been writing very much about the global politics, to really reground myself in San Francisco with a bunch of great San Franciscans. And this is not, each of the atlases has 30 to 50 contributors, done the creative, you know, writers, artists, the great designer Leah Chandra, who gave each of the books and every one of the maps their look. And so it was really also about doing this gregarious, this thing, a kind of city in miniature, people with different expertises and passions from different communities to. So yeah, and this first, the San Francisco one, we had a slow start, and the cartographer and the designer and I took a while to find a kind of common understanding of what we were doing and sort of get up to speed. There was a period where I thought this was a really bad idea, I need to just jettison it. So, but it came out, it became a bestseller in 2010, because I think people love maps and crave maps, beautiful, imaginative, you know, exploratory maps, not necessarily the kind of like raw data on your phone.
And San Francisco was very much in flux at that moment, as it continues to be with dot-com money pouring in a way that it didn't even in the first dot-com boom. The last time I lived in the Bay Area, it seems to have been changed. Even in the East Bay, where I grew up, Oakland and Berkeley have been fundamentally altered by that money, that influx of wealth, in a way that wasn't true that first wave. So did you think of it as a way to take stock about how the city was changing and perhaps what was being lost?
And what's interesting is, you know, I did most of the work on the atlas in 2009. Silicon Valley's supernova, or metastasizing, or whatever you want to call it, had not yet really become so overwhelming. And when I wrote about the Google bus at the beginning of 2013, that was really, in its moment, kind of groundbreaking. And that was the moment, that was like 2012 was when we realized, like, this tech boom and the hyper gentrification, hyper displacement it's producing are overwhelming and devastating, and like the dot-com boom on times 100, and it's just gotten worse. So that, and so like it actually wasn't really part of the San Francisco Atlas. That's the way in which it feels kind of gentle and positive about cities in general and the Bay Area in particular. And you know, in the end of the 1990s, I think the CIA or the FBI predicted three great disasters the United States faced: a terrorist attack in New York, a hurricane in New Orleans, and an earthquake in San Francisco. And those other two things are very much part of the New York and New Orleans Atlas. There's a sense in which the earthquake in San Francisco is an earthquake of money that's shattered a lot of cultural continuity, displaced. But it's part of a larger thing that I think you're really interested in too, which is post-war cities were shaped by white flight. White people thought the suburbs were going to be awesome, and they really wanted to like get the hell out of cities. And I think a lot of people lived in tenements and slums, and city life was transitional and got out. And cities belonged to poor people, non-white people, immigrants, newcomers, bohemians. And then white people in the 1990s decided they wanted their cities back. And we now have this reverse thing happening. Jeff Chang talks about beautifully in his book, It's Gonna Be All Right, where he looks at the geography of places like Ferguson, black people pushed out of central St. Louis to these really blighted suburbs. In the Bay, in San Francisco, black people have been pushed to Antioch, a poor suburb without a lot of transportation and resources and social services. And so we're facing a different kind of crisis, in which I don't know, you go to a lot of cities and they're full of chain stores and white people who want a very safe, very predictable environment. And it's like, oh, you're creating vertical, dense suburbs. And whereas, like, as Jeff talks about, a lot of hip-hop and stuff now in the Bay Area is happening, like, on these suburban corridors and these outskirts. So we're facing, like, I don't even know what cities are going to be.
And that's very much happening here, and it's happening in Boyle Heights. That's where these tensions are being felt most directly, and where the neighborhood itself is fighting back in a way that is different. There's a much stronger sense of community, and the role that neighborhood, after being a Jewish neighborhood, became such a center for not just Latino culture, but Mexican American culture in particular. There's a real sense of that being under threat, and a response that's really stronger than anywhere else in the city in terms of pushing back against that.
I've been reading about it a little bit and really happy to see people who have found ways to defend their places. And, you know, and it's something that I really saw in a different way in New Orleans with Hurricane Katrina, creating mass displacement and shattering people who had long, deep, complex roots in the place, deep relationships in the present, deep to the past.
So let's talk a little bit about New Orleans. How did you decide to make that the subject of the second atlas, and how did you approach that city, which, as you are just saying, has such long, complex history?
You know, I did the first atlas. I directed it alone, which was fine. I know San Francisco really well. I've spent almost my whole life in the Bay Area, my whole adult life in San Francisco with some nice intermissions. But I got very involved in New Orleans after Hurricane Katrina, trying to rewrite the story of the storm from the incredibly racist, authoritarian story of, like, poor non-white people were out of control and we had to send in the army and et cetera to change that, to what really happened, which is, and this is my work on disaster, which is that in a crisis, in the next big earthquake in San Francisco, in L.A., in the next hurricane in New Orleans, in 9/11, ordinary people help each other. They're kind, they're generous, they're resourceful, they're creative. They really hold it together. And often they find this kind of connection and joy in meaningful work and meaningful connections that's missing from everyday life. And so I went down to Katrina, to New Orleans, to document some of these things in Katrina, which became the heavy-duty end section of A Paradise Built in Hell, my book about civil society and disaster. And, you know, and so it felt like, well, there's a quote in the beginning of the introduction to the New York Atlas from Tennessee Williams, who spent time in these three cities. He said that the United States has three cities, San Francisco, New York, and New Orleans. Everything else is Cleveland. And it's like, it's a great catty line, and, like, with all due respect for Cleveland and LeBron James, who did his best thought this week at... you know, I see these three cities as three great cultural capitals, three island republics, in a way with, you know, they're all pretty nearly surrounded by water. And New York is an archipelago, except for the Bronx. New Orleans is much more surrounded by marsh. It looks like solid ground on the map, but that's because the most fundamental distinction in maps is land and water. And in southern Louisiana, that's actually a lot of it is neither land or water.
Somewhere in between.
Yeah, and yes. So New Orleans looks like it's surrounded by solid land with a river to the south and a lake to the north, but it's actually completely surrounded by marshy stuff. That's why it wasn't so easy to evacuate from the city when they cut it off.
Right. In fact, I reported from New Orleans right after Katrina. Yeah. I was sent there by Dean Baquet, who was one of the editors of the LA Times and one of the editors who hired me there. And he comes from New Orleans, and his family has a long history there. And he realized as soon as Katrina hit that this was going to be a story much greater than just disaster. It was going to be a story about architecture, going to be a story about food culture, and sent a whole group of us just to figure out the story from our own perspective. And it really changed the course of, I think, my career as a critic in the way that I think about cities. And it has everything to do with that murkiness. To get there and realize, you know, that all of the great neighborhoods with the great recognizable, mostly residential architecture were dry, and starting to think about why that was, part about a kind of racial privilege, but part about a wariness in the early days of its settlement about the dangers of hurricanes and the river and water, and thinking about building high enough to protect from that. And then the great swaths of the city that were underwater when I got there were essentially suburbanized by something called the wood pump, which was developed in about 1910, which allowed the swamp between the city, between the river and the lake, that sort of back swamp to be drained. And not only was it drained, it was a moment when people were building cities along a kind of Los Angeles model. So they built all of that landscape slab on grade, forgot all the lessons about raising houses above ground, and thought that that kind of technology, that the pump and then later kind of engineering and new levee systems represented, would allow them to build in that part of the world, just like we were building in suburban Southern California. And to think about, you know, just wet versus dry.
Yeah.
Just driving around, yeah, the first day I got there, thinking about wet versus dry and why those neighborhoods. And of course, it's completely tied up with race and class and who can afford to live where, of course. And that's why that was such a it was such a disaster for the parts of the city that couldn't afford those few neighborhoods that, you know, that stayed so high and dry. So it's incredibly complex kind of story that made me think, at any time I go to a city, even just to write about one building, think about those stories. It's really a story that geographers, I think, tell, you know,
yeah,
as well as anybody.
Yeah. No, and it's interesting seeing the ways in which New Orleans has and hasn't come back. But that's a whole other.
So, what's your sense, though, about where it stands now, and what that, how that recovery has?
And it's
has
such
happened.
A mixed bag. And 100,000 Black people were. They say if you couldn't afford to evacuate, you couldn't afford to return. A lot of people got displaced and just didn't have the resources to relocate. So, New Orleans lost 100,000 Black people. A lot of gentrification has happened, and some of it is well-intentioned. A lot of really idealistic young college kids came to help rebuild, fell in love with the city, and are actually really great. Many of them are great contributors to civil, you know, kind of more vibrant civil society in some ways, but some of them are also gentrifiers, and there's like organic tofu in what used to be poor Black neighborhoods now. You know how the flying wedge of gentrification is always well-intentioned white kid hipster culture. And or often is. And, you know, it's a lot less corrupt as a city. There's been a lot of reform in the sort of judicial system and things like that. They have a decent mayor who's trying to take down the Confederate statues. But there was so much trauma from, and it feels like it hasn't necessarily been recovered from. And these open questions about how does New Orleans face climate change with rising sea levels? And there has been actually Rebecca Snedeker, who co-directed the New Orleans Atlas, who's a native New Orleanian and now director of the Center for the Study of the Gulf South at Tulane, talks about how people got really used to looking at maps after Katrina, because there are all these plans, like, you know, and there's this really kind of elite new urbanism where it's like, let's just tear down these neighborhoods because they were badly designed, with no sensitivity to, like, that's destroying deep-rooted communities. But people were looking at different plans about, like, how do we rebuild, how do we redesign, and it created a really vibrant civic life, which is kind of saying, like, you developed a great community around you when you got cancer. It's not like, oh, this is awesome. But it was interesting. And the volunteer effort was extraordinary. Probably the biggest volunteer effort in American history. For years, like, spring break college kids would come down to do demolition and building, and, like, everyone from kind of radical anarchist groups to Mennonites came to rebuild and run community kitchens. And the Rainbow family came. It was extraordinary. And that was a story I was covering. So, yeah, so New Orleans, San Francisco, New York.
So where do you come down? This is the most difficult question, I think, about New Orleans. In those neighborhoods that probably shouldn't have been populated in the first place, or populated in the way that they were because of the danger of flooding, and there are a few people who want to come back, and the city can't afford, or at least couldn't afford right after the storm, to give them the kind of resources. And there wasn't community there because there was such sporadic return. Where do you come down on that question of what to do? This is a question, of course, that Detroit has been, and shrinking cities in general around the country,
yeah,
have been dealing with.
It's funny, I was just thinking of Detroit. I don't know. I mean, the nice thing about being a writer is sometimes you get to be the doctor offers a good diagnosis, not necessarily who has the cure. And so I don't know. And I think it's different for different places. And you do see sometimes in Detroit where somebody's like the last person on the block, but all the other houses, which they do in Detroit, they've pulled down and removed the cement pad and they're farming it. But, I do believe for addressing climate change, density and public transit, pedestrian you know, and public transit adaptation are really important. And it's one of the things I love about Latinoization. Well, most places in California, as they Latinoize, they pedestrianize, although it often feels like there's a race between, will we suburbanize Latinos or will they urbanize us when they come to a place? And, you know, and that builds the kind of resilient community you need in a hurricane. Eric Kleinenberg, who was a real help for the New York Atlas, did a fantastic book about the heat wave in Chicago, looking at who died and how, and seeing like the kind of falling apart, depopulated, poor communities with a lot of fear, and mostly old people who die in heat wave. They're going to be one of the climate change victims, as they have been in Europe. And, you know, and then there's a vibrant Latino neighborhood with the same economic basis, but a lot of trust and camaraderie and sort of, you know, happiness to be out on the streets where the death toll was really low.
And it's something you've pointed out in writing about earthquakes as well, that we talk about natural disasters, but it's really not, it's not nature that kills us. It's architecture, it's zoning, it's building codes, it's redlining, it's all of those human elements.
And I have been to Japan after the tsunami, and the ocean can kill you in tsunami belts. We have some on the north coast of California, not a lot out here. But yeah, and the disaster sociologists like to say there's no such thing as a natural disaster. It's actually one of the things I worry about living in a neighborhood full of tech people is that, you know, I do feel like I'm in one of those zombie movies watching people who haven't made eye contact in years except through FaceTime. And, you know, and I see people who don't know how to go. They don't know where their friends live or what their phone numbers are. They don't have landlines. They don't, you know, that they haven't developed a kind of relationship to the place or the people around them because everything's mediated by digital technology. Like, my neighbor's half Latino and half techie. Like, I'm really, I think a lot of these people who often came from small towns and do manual labor and stuff are going to be awesome in a disaster. And I think the techies are going to be really scary. You know, they're going to be either, you know, like all the cliches about human misbehavior and disaster, which is usually thought of as being about poor people and non-white people. Like, right. I'm afraid it's, I think it's going to be them.
Especially if their phones, especially if their phones aren't working after the earthquake.
No, they're nothing without their phones. You know, there won't be, cell phone towers will go out in the blackout. They won't be able to recharge. And, they won't know, like, you know, it does feel like there are a lot of people who don't know how to walk down the street without digital mediation now.
But it does remind me that you wrote a great book about walking. And
I did. Well, I won't say great. I know I wrote a book about walking. Thank you.
And that, and about walking as a way to read the city. And I'm wondering if that was the beginning of some of the ideas that are in the atlases, that you can't really understand a city at this level without being a pedestrian.
I thought of the first atlas as kind of a global travel in a time of climate change. There's the epigraph for the first atlas is Henry David Thoreau saying, with his usual kind of tongue-in-cheek wit, I have traveled widely and conquered. And Concord is like this little tiny town. What does it mean to travel widely and conquered? And like we have a map in the New York atlas. Our editor at large, who's one of the great pedestrians of our time. He routinely walks all night. He walked for 24 hours to walk a giant kind of O around the city. And it was like, and you know, and it was like a walk around the world. He went to, you know, little places that are Nepalese and Filipino and Burmese and this and that and the other thing. And it's sort of like the whole world is there. And it was a sense of, you know, of local exploration. It was to encourage people to see that you don't have to go far to find the unknown. And it was very, very, also relates to my book, A Field Guide to Getting Lost, which is about the unknown that comes pressing in on the edges of what we know all the time. And one of the first things I did when I started the first atlas is I took out a map of San Francisco, just like your standard AAA map, and looked at it critically in a way I'd never looked at before, and realized, like, I literally had not been, I know San Francisco, I knew San Francisco at that point, I think it's safe to say better than 95% of people. I'd written a bunch of histories, I walk a lot, I knew the central city really well, but I literally had not been to half of the city. I'm sure most of you here have probably been, like the really adventurous of you have been to about 25% of LA. And like I'm very proud to say that I've now been to about 2/3 of San Francisco. But there are all these unknown places and there are all these stories, and the first book is called Infinite City, with a sense that every city is inexhaustible because each of us, you know, has innumerable maps of like who we love and who we fear and where we go and what's unknown to us and where people look like us and where we feel safe. And, you know, we carry all this data, and like you multiply that. How many people are in Los Angeles?
In the county or in the city? About 10 million in the county. So.
Yeah, so like let's say each of them has 50 maps in their heads. That's 500 million maps. You know, like it would take you a long time to explore all those things. And the atlases are very finite, but they're trying to offer a set of, a sense of the possibilities of the infinite variety and of cities as these great places of coexistence. And also looking at what maps can do. They can do a lot more than tell you how to get to the store. And so one of the people I work with in New York, the publicist at Harper's actually, Julia, said this beautiful thing: your phone can tell you where to go, but a good map can tell you where you are.
And it's one of the things I appreciate most about LA is how elusive it is, how slippery it is. And I think one of the reasons it is slippery is because it's underwalked in a way. My colleague at the Times, longtime colleague at the LA Times, David Ulin, has a great recent book about walking in Los Angeles. But for the most part, there remains a big territory of the city that has not been as intensely walked as parts of New York. And that's part of what makes the sense of discovery more powerful here in a way. I think that's changing. I think the kind of pedestrian experience and the literature of that experience is growing a lot richer and has grown richer just in the decade or so that I've been here. But there have been all these cliches about the fact that nobody walks. Of course, those aren't true. Populations of people who walk here, but they have tended to walk much more by necessity, often because they can't afford a car and there's not good, hasn't been good transit here, rather than doing the kind of wanderlust that you've written so nicely about. But let's talk about New York in the few minutes that we have left. As the third city in this trilogy, I'm first curious as a writer how you tackle that research. Were you looking at other? In my world, there are studies like Rum Koolhaas has a really important book called Delirious New York, and even the title Nonstop Metropolis suggests this. There's a Italian collective called Arcazoom that has a project called No Stop City. Were you looking at those kinds of architectural, in particular, attempts to kind of define New York that preceded you?
Now I'm feeling shy about how overlooked, we should have made you do something for that, how overlooked architecture is. But, you know, we came in with a set of commitments that we're going to make an atlas that looked like New York City. First, that meant that there would be we would document all five boroughs, or celebrate, I should say, all five boroughs. And you see a lot of things that are like Manhattan and a little bit of Brooklyn pretending to be a city of five boroughs. So like the Bronx, Staten Island, Queens all get, you know, their fair share of attention. Secondly, was that it was the people who participated were going to look like New York. And Joshua Jelly Shapiro, my wonderful co-editor on this, has just fantastic networks, and Garnett Cadogan too. And they brought in a group that, in their knowledge, in their passions, in their relationship to different neighborhoods and boroughs, and their ethnicities and histories, really reflected the diversity of New York City.
I'm just looking at some of it's an incredible list of contributors: Teju Cole and Margot Jefferson, Barry Lopez, and on and on. Really, kind of an all-star team of contributors.
Yeah. No, I feel like the first couple atlases, I was figuring out how to make atlases. This one, you know, and their weak spot. The first one feels a little bit naive. The second one has weak spots. This one is like, it's strong all the way through. That's partly Josh, and it's partly like, you know, it's partly New York is a great subject. It's partly this time we really knew what we were doing. And of course, it's not hard to find people who are like knowledgeable, smart, literate, et cetera, in New York City. So we just had amazing people to choose.
And some of the themes that you've already talked about in San Francisco and New Orleans come back, particularly climate change, Hurricane Sandy, and money, the effect of money, Wall Street, Occupy Wall Street. That's a big, those two themes are a big, big part of this one.
New York is such all cities are, you know, exist in infinite varieties, and that's part of it. I wanted to, rather than make many maps of many different places, to map the same place over and over with the sense of, you know, when I talk, like I've been talking about the election recently, since everybody's doing their autopsies and Monday Night Quarterback, and I was like, it's sort of like how you slice the pie. But you know, there's so many communities, there's so many histories, etc. And New York is the center, the capitalist center of the world with Wall Street, but it's also been a place of great anti-capitalism. Not only, you know, we have a map called "What Is a Jew," whose subtitle is "From Emma Goldman to Goldman Sachs." Which is about both the diversity of New York. It's also trying to take apart people. Racism is usually based on generalizations. I'm reading Gloria Steinem's wonderful memoir, and early in it she says, "Love particularizes, hate generalizes." And there's, you know, and it's true of any ethnic group and of other groups that are, you know, people say all gay men are like this, all black people are like that, all women are, and it's what leads to collective punishment, et cetera. So, like, that map was really about taking apart the notion that Jew is a simple homogenous category, and there are black Jews, there are anti-Zionist and Zionist Jews, poor Jews, rich Jews, Marxist Jews, Wall Street Jews, et cetera. But it was really trying to represent, you know, also the coexistence of opposites often of, you know, the sort of virulent power structure and its antithesis, which most cities contain. And LA has, you know, powerful corporations with, you know, and sort of sinister conservative forces. And it has these kind of great rebel forces, too. It has, you know, and the depth and width of cities contains these contradictions, these frictions. And so trying to, you know, and even 26 maps, you just begin to sketch out a few of the things that are there.
But that idea about the particular really brings us back to Trump, I think, in a way. There's been so much talk in this kind of postmortem, particularly in the journalism world, about what kind of attention we might have paid to the Trump voter, how much we understand or don't understand the Trump voter, whether the media has failed us in understanding that landscape. And I think that's true to a certain extent, but we haven't talked about the flip side, which is what responsibility those voters owe to the particulars of cities. And I think this atlas makes a very good argument for why that's necessary, that those voters and the way in which, and we should probably talk about Trump's very strange relationship with New York, which is, you know, the city he's lived his whole life. But he really ran on a campaign that was against cities, that was against multiculturalism, that was against cosmopolitanism.
Which every major American city is full of, happily.
Right, and was allowed to kind of demonize. We were talking about this backstage, talking about inner cities, using language that seems right out of the 1970s in a yeah. kind of reading of what cities are and what cities mean.
There's a wonderful line of Kierkegaard's that stuck with me when I was reading Kierkegaard for my book on walking, where he says thieves and the rich have this in common: they live in hiding. And you look at someone like Trump, that, you know, people with wealthy people often lead these, you know, they lead these deeply sequestered lives. And he's probably spent a lot of time at parties on the Upper West Side. He's probably never walked through Harlem. And, you know, you live that super wealthy life and you go from your apartment to your limousine to your private jet, and you lead a life of isolation. You know, it's pretty clear he, you know, there was one debate where he was making stuff like, well, the airport in Kuwait kind of stuff, where he didn't realize, like, not all of us are flying through the, you know, the Gulf states on our private jets and stuff. And so I think that he's somebody, and something that we saw a lot with the, you know, the fearfulness about crime in the 1990s is that, you know, it feels like the more segregated and isolated people are, the more their imagination runs rampant. I think that's why cities are progressive about things, diversity, immigration, race, et cetera, is that, like, we already exist with diversity. And sometimes, and I remember after the Rodney King uprisings, like, weird people in Beverly Hills moving to places that were more fortified and suburban, being afraid that South Central was going to march on, you know, the villas. But but, you know, and this place can have its own isolation because it's so car-based, like all the sort of car-based cities can. But, you know, he feels like a person, a profoundly isolated person. I've also seen with very powerful men create these bubbles where there's no one to tell them when they're stupid, wrong, etc., you know, and it's like hyper, they're like spoiled children with too much power. And he also feels like someone who has not had the feedback you have. You know, I'm a great believer in democracy, the democracy of public libraries, the democracy of walking public streets. And when you live in a community with people who are equal to you, they tell you, you know, they hold you in check. We keep each other honest. We hold each other accountable. We hold each other in check. When you create people, emperors and kings and moguls and et cetera, who are too powerful for that, they're lost. And he, you know, like, we're about to find out a whole lot more about who he is, but he seems like somebody, like, mental illness is not really the right model, but somebody who's so deeply lost from his own and anybody else's humanity. And that's sort of the limousine and mansion life, I think.
And the part of the corrosive effect of money on cities like New York is that they don't have the working class populations that they did. And in a very cynical way, that seems to me to have allowed Trump to demonize the inner city, as he kept calling it, particularly in the last few weeks of the campaign, without much risk, really, of alienating his own base of working class white voters who have been driven out of cities like New York. And it seemed much more, I think in retrospect, it was, given how often he was using that phrase, inner cities, and talking about not being able to walk down the street to get a loaf of bread without getting shot, was highly calculated.
Well, it was, you know, he basically was elected by white suburbanites, and he could blow off cities. I haven't looked at the maps closely, but I suspect, like every Republican, he did not get the urban vote. I do know that that New York City itself voted like 79% for Clinton. And there's that kind of fantasy of cities that I remember when I was writing Wanderlust, there's this statistic, the more you watch local TV news, the more afraid you are to leave the house and the less you actually know where you live. So you become more reliant on the kind of warped picture of local TV news with its if it bleeds, it leads.
It makes me wish that you were working on an atlas of the whole country, because I've been looking at those maps a lot. And it's not just the sort of blue islands in the sea of red, but there are also these incredible moments. If you look at a county by county map, for example, which I've been doing the last couple of days, it's not just blue cities. There's this incredible, in terms of landscape and the influence of geography. If you look at the electoral map of the South by county, there is a crescent of blue in this sea of red, and that crescent actually reflects the richness of the soil and reflects where slave populations were based, and therefore reflects where there are significant pockets of African-American population, which continue to vote Democratic. And so if you're making your way, say, across the South, it's you kind of have to thread through, if you're staying in the red Trump counties, through this crescent of blue, which has this incredibly long history. So it just makes me think that a kind of treatment of that whole map, the way that you've treated the city, would be hugely useful at the moment in making sense of what we've just seen.
Well, I hope lots of people do atlases, and you know, and I am actually talking to a bunch of people about a bunch of mapping projects, and I joke that my goal is to be like Glinda the Good. I want to come in and like sprinkle a little glitter and then like snap my fingers and disappear.
And I think that bigger map also reflects something that is really true of your book on New Orleans, and I think a lot of the really good writing about New Orleans that's followed Katrina, is that thinking of cities not in isolation from their larger connections. You can't think about New Orleans without thinking about the whole landscape, the wetlands, the coastline, the effects and the implications of climate change. You can't think of Los Angeles, and this is beginning to change, I think, how we read this city. Can't think about the LA River and its future without thinking about the debris basins that are way up in the hillsides collecting the hillside as it comes down in a way that normally would go into a river. I think we owe it not just to the study of how this election happened. I think we have to think about the relationship between the cities and the spaces that are sort of left behind, abandoned as more money and population flow into cities. And that's obviously something that's happening around the world, not just in this country.
No, we are in this bizarre thing where cities are. I wrote a book about the dot-com boom and gentrification in 2000 called Hollow City, but there are whole like midtown Manhattan is half empty because, you know, people with Super rich people from around the world are looking for more stable economies to park their billions. And so they're buying these massive apartments that are empty most of the time. And so London and parts of Manhattan, et cetera, are being emptied out. A lot of the luxury condos, which people pretend are solving San Francisco's housing crisis, are being bought as second homes and investments and are empty a lot of the time. So you have this weird kind of emptiness. We're in an era of a lot of kinds of mass displacement, which I was just beginning to fully understand as we're finishing the atlases. We have an amazing map in the New Orleans Atlas about the fact that there's a neighborhood in New Orleans that's the most incarcerated neighborhood in the most incarcerated city in the most incarcerated state in the most incarcerated country in the world. And that essentially this wonderful young writer, Lydia Pellott Hobbs, a protege of Ruthie Gilmore, who used to be down here, brilliant African-American geographer who deals with the prison system in this country, started to look at prisons as suburbs. And I did something recently for Harper's, inspired by that, for a photo essay about the homeless, looking at all these people who are being pushed out of our society, about prisons and homeless people as these sort of two forms of marginalization, the people who are locked up inside with no outside they're allowed access to, and the people who live outside all the time with no inside they're really allowed access to in any meaningful way. And I realized that, like, the good life probably everyone in this room, I hope, is living, is just to be allowed to move freely in the world and have a safe private space to withdraw to, that a lot of people don't. And you see this kind of displacement of poverty where it's, you know, we're now seeing the economic crisis leading to a lot of deaths from just, I think, despair over work and addiction among poor whites. And, and people's housing situations getting more and more dire in the sort of post-collapse, post-2008 economy. But also prison and homelessness and precariousness and overcrowding also in our kind of, as we regress to a kind of 19th century economy of super elites in the desperate underclasses.
And I think these are all beginning to be subjects for criticism, for architecture criticism, for the kind of writing that didn't address those subjects, prison industrial complex, for example, or what you said about vacancy. I think that's a hugely important topic, the vacancy of abandonment in places that are being left behind and the vacancy of those empty apartments. That's something we see in Los Angeles. I wrote a piece about the spec mansions in Arcadia that are being marketed to Chinese buyers that are essentially largely places to park capital. So there's a connection between the empty apartment in Dubai, the empty apartment in London, the empty apartment in New York or San Francisco, and this, in our case, a kind of horizontal version of it, the empty huge McMansion in Arcadia that's just a place to park some capital.
And to live in cities where there's so much homelessness and so many empty homes is part of just sort of the grotesqueness of the misdistribution of wealth in our times, which, given the election, is about to get a lot more grotesque.
Yeah, I just saw a terrific study in London. Somebody has begun to quantify the number of empty bedrooms, extra bedrooms in London. So as people talk about a housing crisis and incredible shortage, actually beginning to quantify how many of those spaces where people could be sleeping or sitting empty every night. So that the combination of sort of mapping and data and these kind of more activist positions is beginning to come together, I think, in a really interesting way. And that might be a way to make the kind of data revolution that you've talked about being alienating more productive, if we can bring those things to bear on some questions that that can have some political agency behind them. So last question before we open it up to the audience and hear from them. I'm curious, in terms of this election, do you see, and what the ways in which you've studied communities coming together in various kinds of crisis, are you hopeful that this can be a kind of galvanizing moment for creative movements, for activist movements, or do you think that's likely to fade over time?
I don't know. And I think, you know, we've seen remarkable organizing. We're seeing it right now around Black Lives Matter and the Dakota Access Pipeline at Standing Rock. I visited there, and it was such a beautiful, amazing thing. And it really felt like that maybe this is a turning point for the 500 years of sort of disenfranchisement, dispossession of Native Americans in North America. And, and so I see those communities. I also have, I think the most polite way I could put it, been extraordinarily disappointed with the behavior of the left in this election and the short-sightedness and divisiveness and misogyny and et cetera. And, you know, so I don't know. And I think that Black Lives Matter will continue doing great work, the Dakota Access Pipeline resistance and the climate movement will, which for a long time has also been an environmental justice movement working with vulnerable communities and with immense leadership from Native people. I think that the Dreamers and a lot of Latin American Latino organizing is fantastic. I did 3 days of Get Out the Vote work with my friends in Northern Nevada, and we, you know, I got to help send the first Latina senator ever to the Senate, and they kept the state blue. They registered lots of voters. I think we're seeing a lot of kind of bigger dreams and broader coalitions that are very exciting, but we're also seeing it coexists with this horrific crackdown and backlash. I mean, the future is not white, and half the five-year-olds in the United States are not white. When they be, you know, that which means that in 13 years they'll be voting. In 40 years, that's what the population will. They'll be middle-aged people, and we will not be a white country. And I think that's a really good thing, given what white people gave us last night. And so there's so many variables. I think it's fascinating to watch all the pieces play. And what has been sort of heartbreaking is that the inability, I think, of kind of the old white left to galvanize anything resembling a real movement. And there's been magic moments like Occupy Wall Street, which has been immensely influential and I think successful. But, Ralph Nader was going to, and the Green Party were going to build a movement after 2000. And like, you may have noticed where that went. And Bernie Sanders, our revolution seems to have kind of crashed and burned in its first week. And maybe it'll get up and move on. But I think finding a way to articulate, like, what are the common goals, the common grounds that we have across sort of racial and economic and geographical and gender differences? What do we hold sacred to and work for together? You know, we need what somebody like Arundhati Roy was 15 years ago, or Martin Luther King was 60 years ago. I feel like we need a great voice who can articulate how it all connects, or maybe we need many voices. And some of the pieces are there.
I think you're right that the schism on the left at the moment is going to be an obstacle to a significant movement that comes together in the short term. On the other hand, I'm really fascinated to watch how the reaction to Trump among younger protesters plays out in physical and architectural space. So even last night there was a protest of very young, very diverse group of protesters on the 101 shutting down the freeway. It first reminded me of one of my favorite lines about LA. Charles Moore wrote 50 years ago. He said, it's fascinating to wonder if there were to be a revolution, an effective revolution in Los Angeles of the Latin American sort. That was the phrase he used to think about where it would take place. And he said, if you had huge rallies in public squares, they would go unnoticed and you'd really have to do it on the freeway. That was his conclusion. And I think that's right, but I also think enough has changed in what the freeway means, particularly for those younger protesters. They don't just see it as a place to get attention. They see it, and from talking to people in Boyle Heights when I was writing about Cesar Chavez and thinking about how that neighborhood has been encircled, really strangled by freeway construction, they see it as an obstacle to connection. They see it as an obstacle to public space, to a kind of communitarian idea of the neighborhood. And so for them, for that generation to be on a freeway is not just to say we're going to disrupt traffic and sort of get on the news. It's to say we're taking on the kind of political structure that has, set Boyle Heights and neighborhoods like it apart and cut them off from the rest of the city. So I'm really interested to see how that plays out and whether we'll have another one of those tonight.
You know, I just want to say I think we're supposed to go to question and answer now, but elevated freeways came down on the Bronx, Black West Oakland, Black Detroit, and so many other cities around the country, like guillotines chopping neighborhoods in half. And it was really like, this is not a place we're living is what matters. This is a place to just move through as fast as possible in a state of disconnection. And our 89 earthquake actually took those freeways down. It broke them, which was amazing. And they've, and it's interesting seeing those things. Robert Moses put the Cross Bronx Expressway through the Bronx as a way to slash its throat as a vital, vibrant, good place to live.
And in terms of being what you've said already about being a pedestrian, reading the city that way, to be a pedestrian on a freeway, which is designed to repel the whole idea of community scale or connection, can be a very powerful act just to walk in that space. So,
but
we'll
I love
see how
the
that
idea.
Plays out.
I love the idea of young revolutionaries taking the freeways. I've shut down a few myself. I saw a great march of brown kids out of a high school on my way through LA today, and honked in solidarity and just, feel for them. Like, it's such a devastating way to be arriving into adulthood as somebody comes into power who tells you, you're a target, you're illegitimate, you don't belong here, you don't have rights. And so there's a lot of work for the rest of us to do.
Okay, so let's open it up to questions. I'm sure there are quite a few. Thank you. And
I can see people now.
While we're doing that, I want to say that map, woman's map of the subway, I hope you make t-shirts, because I really want to buy some for my daughters and others. But
we want to make posters for starters, but
Sure.
Rebecca, thanks so much. McLuhan made a film with Jane Jacobs called Burning Wood. She's hot. There's a new doc on her called Citizen Jane, and there's two new books on Jane Jacobs. Did you ever get any major insights from her studying her?
Absolutely. I read The Death and Life of Great American Cities probably sometime in the 90s. And Jane Jacobs, for those of you who haven't read that, lived in the West Village, New York City, in the 50s and 60s before she left so her sons wouldn't be drafted and moved to Toronto, and wrote a book that went against the grain of what modernist urban planners were doing to celebrate diversity and complexity and kind of the old ways cities function, and to see what they saw as slummy and chaotic. And, and modernism was like, the modernist urban design always reminded me of those kids who were like, the peas must not touch the gravy. It was about like, and it was basically about suburbia. It's like living and working must be separate. Rich and poor must be separate. We must withdraw from public space. We must move through cars. It was like a kind of, and it was really, and she was really mocked for that. My father was an urban planner who had a very snarky review about this, amateur lady who thought, and of course, I think for a lot of younger people, if you read that book now, and there's a kind of success that where like your genius disappears because it now seems like conventional wisdom, and I think I think Jane Jacobs is our conventional wisdom now. So, and she's on the map, of course. So thank you.
Hi, Rebecca and Chris. Thank you so much. I'm just curious about whether you have any thoughts about how communities and neighborhoods changes people's relationship with marijuana and smoking changes. And I ask because I grew up in Los Angeles in Koreatown, and I work in Koreatown, and growing up there were donut shops and liquor stores, and now there's vape shops everywhere, and just in recent years I've just seen that. So I'm just curious.
That's a great question.
Yeah, I don't know. And it's funny because there is a way in which I was thinking of the geography of Northern California. You have Silicon Valley, which could be called distraction, followed by wine country, which could be called intoxication, followed by the kind of marijuana belt, which could be called, stoned. And just that this kind of altered consciousness industries. I wonder Southern California's altered consciousness industries. I don't know if pot growing is big here.
I think a map.
Entertainment.
A map of this kind about the architecture and the geography of pot shops, for example, would be really interesting. I'm fascinated by the architecture and the location of those, and I'm sure that will change now with the proposition passing. But the ways in which they've come into places of kind of least community resistance, and then they have a particular kind of architectural already aesthetic that's mostly about signage and color. But it's on the one hand new, but it's also connected, of course, to the history of kind of strip architecture and signage in Los Angeles that So I'd love to read, you know, I mentioned Charles Moore. I would love to read Charles Moore, a writer like that, or the late John Chase, who wrote beautifully about vernacular architecture, commercial architecture. I'd love to read an essay by one of those writers about the kind of emerging aesthetic of potshop architecture and how that will change. I mean, that's exactly the kind of thing that one could imagine in an LA version of this book, it seems to me. Pete, you're laughing. I'm totally serious, though.
Hi. I've been thinking a lot about floodplains, and there's a movement afoot in a lot of cities, New Orleans, New York, here in Los Angeles, to clear floodplains and get out of the way of the water, both to kind of allow natural systems to take their course, but also because the climate is changing and we need to get out of the way. But also, you know, you brought up this idea of these like deeply rooted communities, and a lot of working class communities, deeply rooted communities, you know, places where I live in the San Fernando Valley, were built in the floodplains. And so I'm interested in what you have to say about kind of the ethical quandary of that, of like kind of resolving nature with those, with, you know, displacing communities.
I don't know that I have any great insights about it. I feel like climate adaptation is going to be a lot of what we do in this century. Parts of the earth will become uninhabitable, will become radically different, will become agricultural, you know, where agriculture thrives will shift. A sea level rise will take away a huge, you know, a lot of coastal space. And I don't know. Is it possible to turn these floodlights off? They've been blinding me all. Like, can we all be in the same light? Like, I should just wear a hat to these things. Like, yeah, thank you. Like, it's burning my eyes, and like, it's exciting to actually be able to see you guys. Do you have thoughts about coastal plains?
I think that, well, I think both in terms of earthquake risk and flood risk, if you're talking about moving certain neighborhoods or lifting certain neighborhoods or hardening them, armoring them, and whatever you're doing to protect against that kind of risk, the question is who pays for it? And if there's not an inclination on the public side to pay for that, where do those costs fall? And given that those communities are already vulnerable, raises a lot of really difficult questions. In Los Angeles, it's playing out. In particular, if you think about the architecture of dingbats, the kind of post-war apartment buildings that are really vulnerable to earthquake risk, and if there's an attempt to retrofit them, you know, where that funding comes from. That's something that's playing out right now in Los Angeles. It's the same thing with flood risk in cities like New Orleans.
Hi. Thank you both so much. It's wonderful being here with all of you guys, especially this week. But Rebecca, I was so curious to what you just said about your disappointment in the old left. I just thought if you could expound on that a little bit. I just found it really, I just want to
Were you disappointed with the old left?
No, actually not. I'm completely inspired by them all the time. So
you completely
completely inspired by them all
the
time.
What do you mean?
They're a source of renewal for me, you know, when I think back to the 60s especially.
Oh, okay. I didn't mean the old left in kind of like the OG left.
What old left?
You know, I just meant sort of the, and I feel like I felt like defeating Trump was paramount for the survival of the whole planet and everyone. The Guardian newspaper made an argument a few elections ago that everyone on Earth should vote in our elections because whoever rules the United States essentially rules the world, and you know, climate like the. Good science says we have 3 years left to do something about climate and before we enter into the kind of worst case scenarios. Like, you know, like we're now at a fork in the road where like if we do a lot to step back from, you know, burning fossil fuel at the rate we are, move away from it, the planet, you know, and every living thing on it, because this affects all species for the, you know, and that, so like we have 3 years to get it right, and electing Trump is almost certain doom. And so in light of that, seeing the kind of, you know, and you don't have to like Clinton, you don't have to think she's magnificent, you don't have to think that her use of a private server You don't have to give a fuck, and I don't give a fuck about her use of a private server. It's like saying she drove across town without a seatbelt, and there could have been an accident, and that's very bad. But in fact, there wasn't an accident, so, you know, finding out so many people on the left were so passionate about State Department security was also really interesting. Who knew? But and I feel like defeating Trump was something that we owed the world, those of us who have the ability to vote, who understood these things. I feel like the media, and it's, you know, for 25 years in failing to make an issue out of climate change, but the kind of infighting and squabbling, I feel like there was massive misogyny from the right, left, and mainstream media and how Clinton was presented. And there was a lack of vision of how, you know, we get a lot done under Democratic administrations. It doesn't mean they're our friends. It doesn't mean we have to like them. It doesn't mean we have to agree with everything they do. And I felt like we didn't even have the right metaphors for what we get. And you're not looking for your best friend here. This is not somebody, as I think Oprah said, you're going to have dinner with necessarily. And it's really, you know, it's like choose your battles. And I think of it being like one of these video game things where, like, are you going to drive into the fiery pit or are you just going to pick the bumpy road or something? You know, and there was this kind of whiny perfectionism. And I felt like the language of citizenship is I have a responsibility to my community and my country to do things even when they're difficult, uncomfortable, challenging, was turned into language of consumerism of, like, I need to be offered a targeted product that pleases me greatly, or I'll just sit here and continue to whine.
In every way, pleases me in every way.
Yeah, and so, you know, and we are not, you know, consumerism is the lowest version of what it means to be a human being. Citizenship is one of the highest ones, and to see that language of consumerism was just such a failure, and all these people who are kind of like, well, I'm not being offered perfection, so I'm just going to be bitter in the corner rather than, like, let's save the world from, you know, a climate denier who's going to withdraw us from the Paris climate promises to bring back coal, withdraws from the climate treaty, build the Keystone pipeline after all. And, you know, and it was so crazy and petty. And it's like, it would have been nice. And I think Clinton didn't say anything about the Dakota pipeline because the union constituency is on the other side of that, but it wasn't. I'm like, who gives a fuck? Donald Trump is invested in the Dakota pipeline, and he will do everything in his power to see that it happens. And so people were unable to choose. You know, the perfect was the enemy of the good. People were sitting around saying, we can't do anything unless it's perfect. And, like, we don't get perfection in a system where a lot of the sort of chaotic, corrupt political system and the diversity of voters. And if perfection is somebody who looks exactly like you, like, there are 330 million people in this country, and you're not going to necessarily get a candidate who's exactly like you, you know, and citizens come to terms with that and work through that, you know. And we, like, California got Kamala Harris, which I think is going to be pretty great, so at least some of the time. But, you know, not all the time. I don't think it's, but that's fine. And, you know, and so it was this kind of Puritanism, and another, like, I'm ranting, but, you know, and the voters who stayed home as much as anyone decided to let the world be destroyed. You know, I didn't know so many grown-ups in the United States were pure, but it turned out that all these people were pure, and voting would render them impure. And it's like, really, you've been a white first world tax-paying capitalism participating fossil fuel using person, and you're still pure? You know, so yeah, so that kind of bullshit from people on the left. And, like, there are great, awesome, brilliant people who did and do amazing work and have great vision. But there was so much of that, and it was so loud. And there was clear right-wing voter suppression of actually trying to prevent people who wanted to vote from voting. But there's a kind of left-wing voter suppression that happens when you tell people that, oh, if voting would change anything, you know, and that's actually funny because there's been this stupid slogan on the left, if voting changed anything, they'd make it illegal. Well, guess what? They're trying really hard to on the part of the Republicans. You know, there was a kind of voter suppression of telling people it wasn't worth it, it didn't matter, that the most important imaginable thing was for the Green Party to get matching funds in 4 years, which they're not going to get because they got 1% of the vote or so. You know, there was no vision about the tremendous calamity we're facing in Donald Trump. And there's even a little bit of fantasy. And I heard a lot of really stupid people say, like, you know, oh, it will produce chaos and then interesting things will come and we'll all be
all
right.
The same nihilism. And nihilism on both sides. Nihilism among Trump voters and among some on the left who decided to sit it out to see what kind of explosion would result politically. But I think, do we have time for one more? Okay, we'll take one more question. I appreciate the rant.
Yes, hello. You noticed that in New York in your studies, that I think you said there were 5 or 6 statues of women, which is striking when you think about statues every place. And I just wondered if you know of any place that is any different.
I don't know. I've seen a number of statues of women. Unfortunately, in London, a lot of them seem to be Queen Victoria. But I think that I've seen Florence Nightingale and suffragists and things like that. And London is a huge city. But it's really kind of about, like, what would it look like if cities had proportional representation? And when I did that map of women, and I had really never thought about it, but as a girl and a young woman growing up, if I lived in a city where great women were celebrated the way great men were, I would have felt really different about my right to have a voice, my future, my possibility. I think it affects all of, you know, you have daughters. I think those things go deep into our bones. I loved it that the young woman who talked to me about it talked about how they felt physically in their bodies. You know, it really, you know, and it's funny doing this work, I started thinking about what is it like being a white man where your greatness is constantly, it's on the money, it's on the streets, it's on the name of states and boulevards and bridges, etc. And it's like, you know, it's just like when you go, like, every once in a while I get a Katniss Everdeen or a Femme Nikita, and I come out of those movies with women action heroes feeling like I have superhero strengths. And it's kind of like being on drugs. And it's like, I've seen probably like 15 of those movies in my lifetime. There's 15 of them playing somewhere in LA right now for men getting the same thing. And I'm just like, what is it like being a white man? Is it like being on crack all the time? You know, so, you know, is it like, some of you are coping very well with it, but you, compared to what everybody else is getting, you are so pumped up by these kind of glorified reflections of yourself, which is another reason why, even if it wasn't everybody's favorite woman, including mine, a woman president would have been really interesting, like a black president has been. But we're in a world that kind of gives vast amounts of space and kind of aggrandizes the identities of some of us and annihilates and withers away the others of us. And I want to see that landscape change. I think one thing to think about with urban design, the next subdivision, they should just name it all after, well, women, and, you know, the next building, the next bridge, the next, you know, and there's a place in Harlem is really interesting in that a lot of stuff is named after black men, but it's still a totally manscape. Kind of place.
And there should be a statue of Jane Jacobs in New York. There should be a statue of Ada Louise Huxtable, the great architecture critic, for that matter. So we can all start making our lists. And one for Esther McCoy, the great female architecture critic in Los Angeles, for that matter. Thank you all for coming. Please join me in thanking Rebecca Solnit for being here.
Aloud is made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, and Errant Fox. Additional support provided by the Los Angeles Public Library, the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, Sharon Oxborough, the Estate of Suzanne Aaron, Donna and Martin J. Wolfe, Julia Meltzer, and individual Library Foundation members. Media support is provided by LA Weekly, KCRW 89.9 FM, and KUSC 91.5 FM. Music by Boya Pongo. Support these free programs by becoming a member of the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. Visit lfla.org for more information. 17.